Hello, welcome to the House of Commons. This is a weekly podcast where we talk about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I used to be a Lib Dem, and now I'm just an independent blogger and podcaster. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Loz Kay, who is leader of the Pirate Party UK. Good evening, Loz.
Good evening, and good to be here in the house.
And I'm also delighted to be joined by Sian Berry, who is an activist and candidate for the local elections in the Green Party. And also, she was the 2008 London mayoral candidate for the Greens, too. Good evening, Sian.
Good evening, nice to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so the first thing we wanted to talk about is David Cameron appears to be trying to draw a line in the sand. He's made some comments about what he would, or perhaps more accurately, wouldn't do if he can't get his pledge to have a referendum on membership of the EU in 2017 in any coalition negotiations that may ensue in 2015. And basically, what he's threatened is that he will refuse to be prime minister. He will stand down. He will resign if he can't get that pledge through. So it seems like he's trying to play hardball. He's trying to kind of pre-cook any coalition negotiations and make it clear that whatever happens, come what may, he's going to get his referendum. I'm sure there's a fair bit of kind of politics at play here, but I'm kind of wondering, does this make him seem like a strong leader, or does it make him seem like a weak leader because he's really having to shore up his flank against UKIP? Sean, what do you think about this?
I think it's incredibly weak, don't you think? I mean, just bringing the idea of coalition talks into it is very much an admission of, we're not sure we're going to get a majority here. It just looks absolutely horrendous for him, and it's another concession to UKIP, isn't it? It's blatant, like, oh gosh, we've lost all our votes to UKIP. We better do something to please their voters, and you see that on like other issues like immigration, and it's horrible to watch them doing that because it isn't necessarily the Tory position to be that right wing. And it does make him look weak, I think, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of strikes me, kind of related to what you just said, is that it's all very well him coming up with new measures that he thinks are going to appease the UKIP tendency within his own party and within his own voters. But every time he's done that, it's like throwing red meat to a pack of ravenous wolves. They just want more and more and more, and it's never enough.
You'd look much stronger standing up for what you think should happen or what you believe. I know he's had this referendum idea for a while now, but to make this kind of really forceful statement right now, it looks like he's been forced to do it, and it isn't good.
Lois, what do you think?
Well, it's yes. I mean, I think it's a real sign that actually, really bizarrely, both the Conservatives and the Labour Party have been really absent in terms of the real debate coming up into the European elections, which obviously we're standing in the Northwest, and obviously the Greens are as well. But so much of the initiative has been taken by other parties, obviously by UKIP, to a certain extent by the Liberal Democrats, and also by, I think, the rest of us. The thing is the question of who he would be in with this coalition. I mean, funnily enough, it's been our position since 2012 in the Pirate Party that there should be a there needs to be a referendum. We need to face this question full on. And actually, our view has always been that yes, we want to argue for in, but also for a very different shape. Actually, also fundamental changing of the institutions in the European Union to make it more democratic. I think Cameron's problem with his referendum is, well, does he really want out of the negotiations? It's essentially like he wants to negotiate a rag bag of powers. I mean, I just talked to one of our Swedish MEPs about it, and it was a bit like, well, it seems like all he wants is kind of concessions for the English sausage kind of thing. But essentially, what actually needs to happen is a fundamental change in terms of how the EU functions. But also, I don't see how he's going to get it because it's like he's basically the Billy No-Mates of Europe and could be increasingly marginalised on the other side of the European Parliament elections.
I mean, do you think that's a fair point, Sean? Do you think that actually, really, what we're going to end up with Cameron is that he won't get any sort of reasonable concessions? He may not even get any because in order to get the kind of concessions he wants through would require ratification by 28 different countries, some of whom would have to have referendums themselves on whether or not they'd be willing to accept the changes. And in the end, really what Cameron is going to be facing is in or out. You know, either you stay in, and maybe there can be further negotiations, but they probably aren't going to happen before 2017 in any meaningful way, or we leave the EU.
Yeah, I mean, I think Loss is right, actually. This what he describes there is very much the Green position on this as well. The question is not, you know, what about Britain's you know, negotiating its own terms within the EU and getting lots of special measures and special concessions and things. It's more about reforming the institution as a whole. So the Green's position on this is basically called three yeses. Yes to a referendum. Yes to staying in, and yes to completely reforming the way it works, because it's not particularly democratic. There's lots of problems with how decisions are made. The Parliament itself is very unpowerful within Europe, and we want to see that change, and the relationship with business. But all those are things that you do from a strong position within Europe. You don't do it by negotiating, you know, concessions for one country. And like you say, getting those through would be really difficult. So, yeah, it's not even a strong European policy that he's got, or strong proposals that he wants to put forward. It's all about, you know, trying to get this and that benefit for Britain, or this and that special deal. And like you said, the 28 countries are not going to agree to that.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that if we have a referendum in 2017, that the in campaign would actually win? Or do you think there's a real risk that we could end up with the kind of the feeling that's abroad, and the surge, the rise of UKIP, and the way, you know, the pretty terrible way in which referendum campaigns seem to be run in this country? I mean, I'm still feeling pretty bruised from how the whole AV thing was run. So much lies in that campaign. And you can imagine with the stakes, I mean, you know, you could argue a marginal change to the electoral system, maybe the stakes weren't so high. But something like we're going to be in or out of Europe, the stakes are massively high. I mean, do you think we could actually win an in referendum under those circumstances?
Well, I think absolutely it's winnable, and also the figures have been pointing more in that direction than I think people were giving them credit for. I think obviously the whole UKIP sort of dominating the news agenda has led to a certain amount of nervousness. But I think absolutely, if we do not, we need to face this issue down now. It's been a kind of poison at the kind of heart of British politics since the 90s. And it's also, I think the longer we leave it, the more likely that we'll be used as a huge stick to beat the establishment with, not really be thought out about the issues. I think obviously any in campaign would have to think very carefully about how, you know, what kind of in we want to see. Because, yeah, absolutely. I think we were all of us who were, remember the AV campaign, and also the very hard edge campaigning of the no, and that was also so that we all have to be very ready for that. But it's absolutely winnable. But it seems like, in particular, I'm amazed. I really don't know where we have the Labour Party on this. It seems like they want to hide away from this and really pretend that it's not going on. But I think we have to face this down now and make the case.
Sean, do you think we could win?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think the risks of leaving Europe would be people would, you know, the whole sort of the way that no campaigns operate on a kind of fear basis, like don't leave, oh, it'll be scary, and that's what's going on in the Scottish referendum at the moment. I think that is what would be done, and that probably staying in would win. I wouldn't look forward to the campaign at all. I mean, having said, you know, in favour of a referendum, I'd kind of dread how it would be. A lot of money would flow in UKIP's direction to fight that, and they would gain a lot from it, I think. I wouldn't like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, already, I think particularly the tone and also the xenophobic tone of so much of the material that's out there, and also the comment. I think I'm quite shocked, and I thought we were better than this, and I think we have to be. And it's also, that's why I'm really sort of proud that, you know, our lead candidate is Maria Tsourlakis, who's a Greek citizen, and also we're saying we're actually saying that the benefits of the freedom of movement is freedom for all of us. It cuts both ways, but we have to make that case against that sort of tide of just really troubling xenophobic rhetoric that's bubbling up. Well, not just here in Britain, but also in France, the Netherlands, in Sweden, you know, and Hungary. It's really alarming.
Okay. I think we should probably move on to the next topic because we're in danger of just agreeing with each other for the next 10 minutes. Okay. So the next thing I wanted to talk about, especially as we've got you on, Sean, is fracking, hydraulic fracturing, to give it its full title. We have talked about this on the podcast on a number of other occasions with varying degrees of kind of knowledge and expertise. Obviously, with you being a member of the Green Party, and it's something that they're very heavily campaigning on at the moment. I mean, what are your thoughts on fracking? Is it really as dangerous and as nasty as the Green Party suggests it is?
I think that there's a lot of risks and a lot of unknowns when it comes to doing that. And don't forget, I mean, it's one of those things where you have lots of little drilling rigs placed all over a landscape. It's very disruptive and very destructive when it is done across a wide area. And you know, the leaks that you get, the leaks potentially into the water, the actual fracking itself, you know, attacking the bedrock. You know, there were earthquakes that we think were probably caused by fracking that's already gone on in this country. That's pretty scary. And also, the leakage of methane that you get does a lot to damage its environmental credentials. I mean, it's gas, but it's not, as in, like, North Sea gas. It's gas that's taken out in a very messy way, uses a heck of a lot of water, and isn't environmentally more friendly than coal in lots of ways. And also, it's a massive distraction from what we should be doing. It's, you know, when we could just put up some wind farms on more or less the same landscapes, not necessarily in national parks, should I say, in case anyone's listening. I think, you know, and then wind farms are not destructive. There are no risks. If you find that the wind farms get, you know, not in the right place, you can take it down and move it somewhere else. And, you know, it seems like a massive, massive risk to take for very small benefit. And the benefits all seem to go to the big business, the big fossil fuel companies who want to keep their profit margins up and are prepared to get the government to change all its planning laws to make it happen. And I think that's really, really dodgy.
I mean, but my perspective on this is that, I've always been in favour of renewable energy. And I really do think that we should pour probably more resource than we currently do into that. And I always find it a bit strange that people on the right seem to be opposed to renewable energy, because it strikes me that often the right people on the right do think that technological solutions are the way forward. So, you know, things like nuclear energy, they always seem to be in favor of that. And yet when it comes to renewables, they just kind of talk it down. They talk about how it's a blight on the landscape and we don't want wind farms here, and, you know, solar, it doesn't generate enough and the wind doesn't blow all the time. And, you know, they always come up with objections to it. Whereas if there was just a really focused investment over the next 20 or 30 years, I mean, my feeling is really with, you know, I don't want to mix my metaphors, but with the following wind, we could end up with, you know, renewables being the majority of the energy mix. However, I am not necessarily against fracking. I saw a television program a year or so ago by Dr. Ian Stewart, who does these programs with the BBC occasionally, and he seemed to be with a fairly open mind trying to investigate how fracking had played out in the US. And I mean, it did seem that quite a lot of the scare stories that people talk about, you know, with the pollution of the water supply and turning on your taps and lighting the methane that comes out of them and all of that stuff, is fairly overblown. I think there was some evidence that if the the wells aren't drilled correctly, there is a small risk of leakage. But generally, if they're drilled correctly, then that doesn't happen. And that quite a lot of the situations that they've found where, you know, there does seem to be methane leaks, those kind of things happen anyway. Fracking, it's possible, could exacerbate them theoretically, but there was no evidence that that was happening. So it kind of strikes me that, you know, there's quite a lot of kind of propaganda, and obviously the Green Party opposing it, you'd probably expect the Green Party to oppose it, but it didn't particularly strike me that a lot of the objections were based in evidence. It seemed more like a kind of almost instinctive reaction against pulling yet more fossil fuels out of the ground. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I think that is part of it as well. I mean, it's like, hang on a minute, what's this? You're finding more fossil fuels to drill for when actually you've got, like you just said, and in this huge business opportunity of renewables. I do also find it really bizarre that the entrepreneurial, you know, Thatcherite right aren't going, gosh, look, there's money in renewables. There's already 100,000 people in this country working in renewable energy. That's 100,000 new jobs that it's created. And we've barely scratched the surface on the way to our targets. There's loads more to come. And it's just, it's weird. It seems to be quite a good example of like the established businesses defending their turf and doing a lot of lobbying to try and sort of make their continuance more of the, rather than something new. It's more to do with, you know, what businesses that already exist and the size of those versus perhaps the size of the renewables companies, which are smaller. It seems very odd to me.
I think in particular on that, there's, because we've just seen that in the course of this week in terms of the House of Lords Committee, which has been urging essentially the fast-tracking of fast-tracking of fracking. And there we go, a little rhyme in there.
That's an excellent slogan there, Lars. Well done.
Yes. But I think it is very much, it's also actually, I think it's very clear in terms of when you look at the people who are behind that is about investors' interests. I think this is an area where also there's, I do share your concerns, Mark, about in terms of also that knee-jerk reaction in terms of looking at evidence. And there has absolutely been a lot of things which have been overblown. So I think we do need to be careful. And I think this is even where, as far as the Pirate Party is concerned, is that it is about getting an effective and environmentally sound policy to deal with the increasing of generating capacity. And we do need to focus on renewable energy, but there is still a room for other technologies in there, which include nuclear, and it's that because we have to actually look at both continue our generating capacity and also transit towards more renewables. I think, our big objection, I think, is very much to do with about how people get democratic control of what's happening over land and what's around them. And then I think that's why also the Tories are also so folk got a bee in their bonnet about wind farms. Obviously, it's about their turf and about it's the sort of backyard syndrome. But the power is going to have to come from somewhere. And that's also what we need to kind of sit down and focus on.
Okay. Obviously, we're not going to solve the question about fracking. But Sean, do you think that actually we're going to see more and more of these hydraulic fracturing wells being drilled, and they will actually become a significant part of our energy mix? I mean, did you think that maybe the sort of stuff that's happening with Russia and Ukraine is just going to drive this forward because we don't want to rely on Russian gas for the next 20 years, and frankly, we probably can't rely on it?
Well, we could make ourselves energy independent from Russia in other ways, frankly. But yeah, you're right. There was an opinion poll this week that YouGov did. It was a repeat of one they'd done in December. And they were asking people, are they more or less in favour of fracking? And people had shifted more against fracking in general when the question was just asked like that. But when they then said, thinking about what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, how do you feel about possibly fracking being some way of becoming it. There was a really leading question.
That almost sounds a bit like a push poll.
When they did the push question, the push question had more effect recently than it had done when they asked it in December on shifting people a bit more less against fracking. And it is quite finely balanced in the people's minds at the moment. But again, you know, it's fracking is not, it's not a panacea. It's not going to generate that much gas for the amount of effort, for the amount of trouble, for the amount of traffic it generates. I mean, you've seen the protests at Belcombe, where basically the people were stopping the work going ahead by stopping the traffic. They were stopping the lorries that need to go in, the lorries that need to go out. And so, you know, any kind of, I work as a transport campaigner, and any kind of technology that just leads to loads and loads of traffic is not good in the first place, no matter what you think about, you know, whether or not you can regulate it sufficiently to make it safer than what's happened in America.
Okay. Good stuff. Well, yeah, we probably need to move on to our next topic. And because we've got Loz on, I wanted to talk about copyright in general, and also specifically, I believe that there's been an attempt this week to revive some of the stuff from the dreaded Digital Economy Act that was pushed through in the dying days of the last Labour government. I remember there was a lot of campaigning on it and a lot of disappointment when it did finally go through, although I'm not sure that much has kind of happened with it, because I think a lot of what was proposed they've kind of recognised wasn't really practicable. But I believe this week there's been some agreement that ISPs are going to have to send out threatening letters, or, you know, warning letters to people. And I think the phrase I saw was trying to educate them, in quotes, as to, you know, the legal sources for downloading. But Loz, what do you think about this? Do you think this is just a kind of dying gasp of that kind of digital economy
ism? It's the music and film industry lobby stamping their tiny little feet, because they were unable to get what they want through democratic means, because the provisions of the Digital Economy Act itself had stalled, particularly because it's seen as being politically poisonous to be essentially anti-internet. So what the story was this week is that it's an independent agreement between between the major bodies like the BPI, who's the big music lobbyists, and the big ISPs, so BT, TalkTalk, and Virgin, and so forth. That essentially what it means is that they would have to spy on your internet connection to also check what you're downloading. The industry will pay 3/4 of the program, but also we will all of us who have one of the big four ISPs will be also contributing for the privilege of being spied on. And then it's so essentially then letters, which are educational letters, will be sent out to so-called pirates and infringers. So this is blanket. Obviously, you can't tie that to a particular person. You can only tie that to a particular IP address. So no one has shown that this will actually do anything to benefit any artists. All it is I think all I can see it is a kind of possibly a work creation screen for Royal Mail. But what it will do is that further down the line, the industry lobbyists are hinting darkly that if nothing changes, that they will be asking for further sanctions. But also, this is particular. I mean, it's an entirely empty gesture, but with a dangerous threat further down the line.
Sean, what do you think about this? Do you think people should just be able to download whatever they want?
I don't think anyone should be able to spy on you or, like you pointed out, prosecute you on the basis of an IP address when there's no proof at all that it was you downloading stuff. I mean, I used to be quite involved with Open Rights Group, so that's how I met Loz. I know the struggles they went through trying to stop the Digital Economy Act. And how long ago was it now then? Was it 2009?
It was kicked off in 2009 and also it was passed through in 2010.
Yeah, it was in the wash-up period of the last Labour government that they just pushed it through.
So it has actually taken them ages to want to do anything as a result of it then.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because it was partly because they stuffed it up by pushing it through in the wash-up period. So, and then there's been a lot of arguments about how this letter-writing procedure was supposed to go. I've been to meetings at Ofcom, along with people from the Open Rights Group, because they were talking about also the provisions, and we and Open Rights Group were also putting our point of view. I mean, all credit to Ofcom is actually that they recognise that we're the important political force in terms of talking about this. I mean, I appreciate the support that we've had to a certain extent from Liberal Democrats and Greens, but it also kind of shows why we're valuable, because we can see that on the European level, is that it's that because of the experience and knowledge we bring to digital issues, and that's why we're important. Let's face it, there aren't enough people with this kind of background in politics. This keeps on coming back round, because also that these are very strong lobbies.
Yeah, there was something very interesting that happened a few years ago when I was a member of the Lib Dems. There was an infamous conference call that was given by someone who was a close advisor to Nick Clegg, and I think there were a few people from the party in various capacities on the call, and then there were a bunch of Lib Dem bloggers. I didn't write about it at the time because I kind of felt like it was private, but enough of the other people who were on the call have written about it since that I kind of feel like I'm not really breaking any confidences since it's been widely reported. And it was quite shocking, the lack of technical knowledge that the people who were kind of representing the leader of the party had about it. Was specifically about the idea of being able to, trace and basically spy on phone calls that are made over voice over IP networks, or like Skype and the like. And they just didn't seem to get the fact that they were saying, oh, no, but it's just, it's just routing information. We're not interested in any of the other information. But the problem is that with these voice over IP networks, what you often find is that in order to get that information, you actually have to unpack all of the other stuff as well. It doesn't come separately. Like in a normal telephone exchange, you can separate the routing data from the content. But with the voice over IP system, you can't. And they just didn't quite seem to get that. And the thing is, Lib Dems as a bunch generally are quite tech savvy. I mean, I myself, have been programming computers since I was 8 years old. I'm a director of a company, a software company that I set up a few years ago. And I know about this stuff. And there were other people on the call who know even more about that stuff than I do, the bloggers. And it was just really quite shocking to hear the kind of the lack of expertise coming basically from the centre of the party. And that's fair enough, because you can't expect leaders to know everything and necessarily all their staff to know everything. But I think it is pretty widely acknowledged that there are very few people in Parliament that have enough technical knowledge to be able to do these issues justice.
Sure. I mean, you're absolutely right, Mark. It's knowing who to ask, because you can't know everything. I mean, you have to be interested, but you do need to know who to ask. But I'm absolutely staggered, given actually I know that a lot of Lib Dem activists are very passionate about these issues. But this is another area where the Lib Dems have hugely let us down in coalition from mass surveillance. Yeah, we get nice, fluffy declarations at conference from the Lib Dems. But the truth is, they are in a government that is perpetrating an extraordinary blanket mass surveillance. Now we know, thanks to Snowden revelations. Also, now, indeed this week's reports are correct, is that we, essentially, under the Liberal Democrats, we will be getting the Digital Economy Act, all in terms of the key things that people are objecting to, which was this so-called graduated response. And also, there is site blocking now in the United Kingdom. And, because we've had that through injunctions, and it ended up in this ridiculous situation in 2012 where the BPI was threatening to take me to High Court personally over a proxy which we made for a political demonstration. So I'm really hugely disappointed in that. Also, there's another level where I feel that the Liberal Democrats have let us down profoundly, and just as much as the other areas where lots of people are passionate about, whether it's the NHS, whether it's tuition fees.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I should slightly stick up for colleagues in my former party in that, I mean, you kind of suggested that at conference they have these kind of gestures, but then in government they do the opposite. Really, I mean, the way the democracy works in the Lib Dems is that the party members are supposed to make the policy, and they do vote on policy. And generally that has worked fairly well, but there are certain areas where I think most members would agree the mechanisms haven't been working correctly. So, you know, there was the whole issue of secret courts, and, you know, the party membership made its views very clear on two occasions, and yet that still went through. And I know a lot of members are very angry about that. It is one of the reasons I left. But I mean, there were a lot of complex reasons why I left, but it was certainly one of them. And I am disappointed that the kind of the democratic nature of the Lib Dems hasn't percolated through to the upper echelons of the party, in that, you know, they haven't blocked things that the party would have wanted blocked. But there are lots of Lib Dems at grassroots level who are still in there fighting the good fight. You know, I hope it works out better. But, you know, I think even steadfast Lib Dem campaigners, even they would agree that, you know, that the government, you know, the Lib Dems in government haven't covered themselves in glory on all of these issues. And I think that's a fair point. Sure. I'm hearing a sarcastic laugh there.
Yeah, I think it's, you would have expected that the Lib Dems, you know, who have, like you say, voted through some good policies on civil liberties, it's very much one of their issues. You would have expected them, when they came into government, to have made a difference on this issue. And you're right, some of these things are really, really creeping back now. And I'm not sure they're responsible for the stuff that Snowden exposed, particularly. I'm not quite sure which politicians were aware of that.
I think the most frightening thing about some of those revelations is that probably no politicians are responsible.
Yeah, exactly. That's completely outside of democracy, and that's terrifying. That's one of the terrifying aspects.
But yeah, with Tempora, I mean, specifically, you know, we kind of also, we've seen some things that we're reporting in The Guardian are post, you know, are going into 2010. So it's absolutely at the current government's door.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, on your thing about politicians not grasping the technical issues, I think that's quite true, actually. And again, you have a couple of quite good Lib Dems who understand these kinds of things. Julian Harper, I think, is one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Greens, if I can stick up for the Greens a bit, we are very close to the Pirate Party, and some of our European MEPs are extremely good on these issues. But I think in general, what we do is, I mean, we may not understand, you know, the difference between voice over IP or, you know, what happens with packets here and there and all that kind of thing. But we very much have the philosophy of sticking up for freedom, privacy, and also having quite a strong affinity for the kind of sharing culture that is what they're trying to stamp out with the Digital Economy Act. So I think philosophically, we do tend to come down on the right side of all these issues. And we want people to be free and unspied upon, and for internet traffic to be, you know, neutral and private and your own thing. So,
yeah. I mean, maybe that's a good point to just kind of move into our last topic that I wanted to talk about, which is more kind of general discussion, really, just about small parties. Because obviously you mentioned that quite a lot of what we've discussed here, both of you seem to agree with each other. I'm kind of wondering, is there going to be some kind of merger on the cards for the Greens and the Pirate Party UK? Are you going to be standing on joint tickets in places? I'm struggling to get a cigarette paper between you on most things. But I mean, more generally, the only reason why you would even ask that question is because in our system with first past the post, it's very difficult for small parties to get a foothold anyway. And, you know, in the past, you know, in the history of our country, we have seen things like joint tickets and, you know, parties end up merging with each other, because the problem is if they fight with each other, then they split the vote on the left or on the right. And we're kind of seeing that with UKIP at the moment. But, I mean, Loz, if we can start with you, Pirate Party UK, that's only been going for a few years. And I think it's the party has had some electoral success on the continent, but in this country, I think I'm right in saying that you have no elected representatives at all. I mean, how are you finding how the British political system treats you as the leader of a small party?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's very noticeable that obviously in terms of the electoral system makes it, it's problematic, and it makes it more problematic to break through. But, you know, to a certain extent, I don't think that's not the most important thing to me about it. What I find is most problematic is the kind of the deadening effect that it has on democratic participation. And that's something that I'm very passionate about, not least because, you know, I stood in a by-election for Manchester Central seat in which actually 17% of people turned out. You know, it's that, and I think it's that that's the hugely, the big problem is it's about a sense of kind of alienation from the democratic process. But I find it, as a leader of a small party, is that actually it's us, it's going to be from people like us that any change can happen, because the reception is, we don't do just things online. We do go out and talk to people and do the classic doorstep stuff. And there's a huge relief, frankly, when we're not from one of the big three parties. And there are people who are lost now to either currently taking part in the democratic system at all, or to parties like UKIP, that it's going to take other forces to get them back because of the deep resentment. I mean, particularly here in Manchester, where I stand and I campaign, this is also years-long resentment about feeling let down by all, but both of the coalition, but also equally by the Labour Party. To that extent, I'm never going to stand up and say, "Oh, poor us! Isn't, you know, wouldn't it be lovely for us if if it were all easy? And yes, it could just be like Iceland, and yeah, we've got three members of parliament there, and that, you know, that can happen quicker." It's more difficult, but that makes it working all the harder.
I mean, Sean, obviously, the Greens are in a bit of a different position in that they've been going for a very long time. And you do have representation in the European Parliament and have had for a long time. And you now also have a Member of Parliament, although I'm guessing it's probably almost in the lap of the gods whether Caroline Lucas retains her seat. I think the only reason she managed to win it is because it was kind of a 3 or 4 way split down in Brighton Pavilion. But they're the kind of, vagaries that you're having to battle with in order to, you know, to get representation at a Westminster parliamentary level. But you have managed to get there. You're kind of just peeping over and just able to just get there. I mean, from your perspective, how do you see the political system in Britain?
Well, yeah, I mean, we do have an easier time of it than the pirates, I think. For a start, we're not a niche issue, so we can pile into local politics and work on local issues and build up a following and win seats. I mean, I'm standing in the local council elections in Highgate in Camden, and I'm helping to defend a seat that we've held for 8 years there, and I'm trying to win more seats. Previously, we've had three in that area. So, you know, we are an established party there. It's no problem for us to knock on doors in this quite small area because we've concentrated and worked there for a long time. And the Greens have got, 140-something councillors across the country. I probably should know the number, but I don't. And that's quite good. And we get, whereas PR, we do very well. We've got 2 London Assembly members. We've got 2 MEPs at the moment. And we're this close to getting more MEPs. So in the Northwest, but there's those. So I should say that. But I also say that I think it's really important to have a rich ecology of smaller parties, particularly ones that have particular expertise. I think that would be a fantastic thing for politics, and for that to go right through our political system with proper reform would be great. Because in Europe, you can do that. In the Northwest, I should say, I see, this is where I have self-interest, because in the Northwest, last time in 2009, we were 5,000 votes or less short of winning a seat. And we lost out on the final seat to the BNP. So Nick Griffin won a seat, and Peter Craney, my friend, my candidate up there, didn't win a seat by 5,000 votes. And that was so gutting. And you're there and you're looking and you're seeing that the left-wing No to EU party are getting, 10,000 votes. And you think, well, if they just haven't stood, those were our votes, you know what I mean?
That's kind of interesting, because obviously it's that we decided to stand in the Northwest, in terms of our pirate party. Simply also, I mean, because we have fantastic candidates, and I would love to see Maria.
For that reason, I'm not against that, and I think you can't look at it like that. Like, those are our votes. The Lib Dems are telling us we're taking their votes. And we're letting in the Tories and things like that.
That's funny. I thought the Lib Dems always claimed that only they could win here.
Yeah, they're probably going to put that out in Highgate when they got 100 votes in the last by-election. I'm not against it. I just think that parties should stand. Parties should work and try and win seats. And
but isn't it interesting though, Sean? Sorry to interrupt, but I was really intrigued by what you said about, you wish that we could have this kind of rich ecology. What I find most fascinating in the last 5 or 10 years in UK politics is that it is happening. It's happening despite our electoral system. And it's not just happening in little flash in the pan parties. I mean, I get the feeling the Pirate Party is here to stay. UKIP are now, they're virtually, in terms of the polls anyway, neck and neck with, the main parties now. And that's like
a Lib Dems in some of the polls as well. And I think that's really making people think. And I think that the electoral system will catch up with that if we keep pressing on the way that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wonder, if just in the end you've got so many parties and, some of the smaller parties are getting, 1-3%, but you've got, slightly bigger parties getting 5-7%. And you've just got so many votes for so many different places. In the end, I could imagine a situation where a government gets in with a majority in Westminster with less than 30% of the national vote. I mean, that could easily happen if this kind of trend continues. And I kind of think, like, at that point, the electoral system will have to catch up in some way, because otherwise you can almost roll the dice for who's going to be in government and who's going to get seats. And it's not going to seem democratic at all. But as I warned you both at the start, before we started recording, I do turn every discussion into a discussion about how great electoral reform will be. And I've managed to win that. No,
yeah,
it's time, so.
Yeah. Well, but I think you're absolutely right. We have seen, I mean, that there is an increase in different kinds of candidates, and also that we can, and also that choice is really important. I mean, also people can also know, in terms of our local candidates, we're kind of starting to do that. But also, that what's very interesting is that saying that there's the huge range of policies that the kind of Pirate Party has, and how we do politics is what really marks us out from everybody else. Our crowdsourced manifesto involving thousands of people online. I think we're just as much interesting for how we do politics as well as the kind of full range of policies that we have. So I think it's about being able to inject different ways of in terms of to reinvigorate democracy. Because I think I agree with you, Mark. I want to see electoral reform. I think it's still going to be a long time coming after the whole AV thing, but that's not the end of the game by any means. Is that we also need to be completely reinvigorating the sense that you are able to take part. And that's one of the things that we're very passionate about. And, that's as much what we're about as a lot of the kind of so-called techie issues. But it's hard. It's really hard, because the alienation is very big.
Well, I mean, on this podcast, we have tried over, and it's been going for a few years now. And we have had people on from obviously the main parties, but also from all sorts of other parties and non as well. You'll be pleased to hear, Lars, we actually did have someone else who was a member of the Pirate Party on about 18 months ago. He's not actually, I don't think he knocks on doors. He's like an activist in that respect, but he was technical editor of PC Pro magazine, a chap called Darian Graham Smith. And he actually, when we were talking, said that he, because I said, are you a member of a party? He said, yeah, I'm a member of the Pirate Party. So, we did also have a Green on as well, Sean, although he then defected to the Lib Dems a few weeks later. I don't think it was my influence that did it, but...
That doesn't happen. What are you talking about?
I'm afraid it did on this one occasion.
That's so rad.
Anyway, I think we've probably just about reached the end for this week. So I'd just like to thank both of my guests. Thanks to Loz Kay.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks. Very much enjoyed it.
Thank you. And also thanks to Sean Berry.
Thank you for having me. It was great. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And I'd like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And next week, conservative activist Nick Dennis will be here with some guests covering the previous week's politics.